This is China Law and Policy, and welcome to our podcast. Tibet is considered the Buddhist capital of China, causing many not familiar with China's geography to believe that Buddhism came to China from India through Tibet. But with the highest mountain peaks in the world, the Himalayas, separating India and China, Buddhism had to take a different route. Instead, it entered northern China through what has become known as the Silk Road. As a result, some very early Buddhist art can be found in remote northwestern regions of China. One such example are the Buddhist cave art in Dunhuang, an oasis town situated in the Gobi Desert. The Mogao Caves are probably the best known. But any trip to the Mogao Caves by a Buddhist art novice leaves one with many questions on the art, the history, and its significance. Fortunately, China Law and Policy had the opportunity to sit down with Dr. Neil Schmid, an American expert on Buddhist studies in Dunhuang. Thank you for joining us today. First, can you give us a little bit of background on the caves? When were they first constructed, why, and by whom?
Elizabeth, thank you for inviting me. So there's a story, maybe apocryphal, that in 366, a monk by the name of Ledzun had a vision. And this is a vision that happened outside of the oasis of Dunhuang in a small ravine with a cliff face. And there he had this vision that he was basically to build a cave. Dig a cave. And so this is, again, maybe it's apocryphal, but this is the originating story of the Mogao Caves.
And what year was that again?
366.
Okay.
Yeah, right. And so he was followed by another monk, Fa Liang, and then a series of monks after that.
And so can you explain more, like, why these caves were created?
Well, as I said, initially they were dug out as meditation spaces. So spaces where monks could live relatively distanced from Dunhuang or some sort of urban or town center, and do spiritual practices. And this is the origin of these caves. And then what happens over time, over the centuries, is that the site becomes a pilgrimage site. And with these powerful monks, spiritually, that is, people began to patronize them. And in doing so, they began to build caves themselves. And these people were typically the elites or also groups of people who would gather together and fund the digging and the construction of a cave in Mogao, in this area. You asked about whom they were actually built by, right? So they had funders, they had donors. But there was, and we have a lot of information from the 10th century on, but we have... We know that it was a professional class of artisans who actually did the construction work, painters, sculptors, metalsmiths, textile workers, and they were organized hierarchically according to their expertise, and their titles reflected their skill and their standing. So these are the people who actually built the caves, and we can talk a little bit later about that process of building itself.
Mm-hmm. And so that's interesting that you talk about the professional class of artisans and also just the changes over who was sponsoring the building over centuries. And I guess, like, when you go to the Mogao Caves themselves, you do see some changes to the art when you visit different caves. Can you explain more, maybe, or highlight what some of those changes are from the beginning to the later parts? And do you believe there's a high point to the art itself?
Mm-hmm. So the earliest caves we have are from the northern Liang, and that's 397 to 439. And these caves are very, very heavily influenced by Indian and also Central Asian styles. The motifs, the iconography, the sculpture... is very, very much dominated by something other than Chinese. And over the years, these artistic forms and iconography and also the ritual space itself begins to shift away from monks towards an increasingly lay-oriented perspective. And so what the caves also take on in terms of transformation of the styles, the artistic styles and ritual styles, is an increasingly Sinicized, i.e. Chinese aesthetic. And so, for example, what happens later is you have stories about India and about the Buddha done completely in Chinese costume, in Chinese-like settings, and it naturalizes in some ways Buddhism for Chinese, and we see this very clearly evidenced in the caves.
And do you believe, like, at any point, I mean, I know some art historians believe that some dynasties had better art than others or higher end art than others. Do you believe that? I mean, do you agree with that? Is there any dynastic? I mean, I think everybody always thinks the Tang Dynasty, but how would you how do you deal with that? Do you believe there's any part that's?
No, that's a good question. I mean, I could talk about my personal favorites. You know,
it's okay.
But thanks. But I mean, I particularly like Tang. Okay. What's known as High Tang style. But it's very, very difficult to say one style is a high point. Obviously, it depends on the reference points of what you consider, you know, a high point. I mean, there's amazing artistic skills that go into the creation of earlier caves in terms of actual painting styles and things like that, which are now lost in China. So in some ways, you could say, oh, due to the introduction and then disappearance, these were high points in particular artistic styles.
Right. So, okay, that's fair. I mean, I guess the other thing is when visiting the caves, I think you can't help but wonder, like, how starting in 400 AD, people were able to paint and build such amazing art. And, I mean, in particular, there's that one awe-inspiring Buddha. Do we know exactly, like, how these caves were built, how the painting was put onto the walls, and how many people it took to build these caves? And I think you were already talking a little bit about the professionalization of the artisans. I mean, if you could go into a little bit more depth about that.
Sure. So what happens after, in the Tang and also Five Dynasties period and also in the Song, is that you have elite families funding the construction of caves. And in the process, they create what is essentially a painting academy. And at this painting academy, you have trained artisans. And note that they're laity. They're not monks. They're not clerics. And we have lots and lots of documentation from this period and detailed manuscripts about what they were paid, how often they were paid, you know, where they lived, etc. The types of work, their individual specialties, and we know that laborers were typically paid in food, so cooked meals, also oil, also grains, and so this was a typical form of payment. And how the caves themselves were actually constructed, they were constructed by starting at the top of the interior of a cave, and then digging it out and down. And so what they would do then after it was dug out is they would begin to sort of burnish, if you will, the walls, and then apply a straw and stucco mix. And then on top of that, begin the painting process. In this period, very late Tang, Five Dynasties period, Song period, it became very programmatic and very organized in terms of the pictorial program of the caves themselves, and very standardized. And they used a variety of drawings, for example, to create on a regular basis the paintings in the caves. They also used something called pounces, which is a piece of paper with dots cut in that they would then typically blow a paint across to get an outline, and then they would color that in.
Yeah.
So one of the motifs you see again and again at Dunhuang in the Mogao Caves is the Thousand Buddha motif.
Right. You see, like,
exactly.
They did it in, like, an assembly line.
Exactly. So there's this whole modularity to the construction and also the painting process. And then the paints themselves are typically use things like the expensive ones, lapis lazuli and malachite and things like this. So the painting was done on dry stucco and again through a series of artisans. And the construction of a cave, a large cave during this period would be perhaps a year. So it would take a year to do this.
About a year. Okay. And just to move away from the art to the political, I mean, I know when I visited the Mogao Caves, it appears that for foreigners visiting the caves, part of the tour is a stop in a separate building documenting the Western countries' purchasing and taking of the Mogao's manuscripts and cave art at the turn of the 20th century. I mean, we know that in the case of the British, they purchased from the monk in charge of the caves at the time the world's oldest printed book, the Diamond Sutra. They had examples of an American explorer also purchasing some old Buddhist manuscripts, as well as physically lifting some of the cave art out of the caves. I guess in that period, why were Westerners so interested in the Morgau Caves, and how did they even like know about it to go out there?
Yeah, great questions. So the first visitors, in fact, were not the first visitors were before 1900, and they were typically involved in exploration and survey. And this has to do with what was called the Great Game, the machinations between the United Kingdom and Russia, the Russian Empire, to control Central Asia. And so it was through that process that Central Asia began to be known. And while we have these military and quasi-military figures in Central Asia, they discovered the first sort of striking discovery was something called the Bauer Manuscript.
Okay.
And this manuscript was a shock, because here in Central Asia we find a birch bark manuscript from the 4th to 6th centuries in what's called hybrid Buddhist Sanskrit, or kind of Prakrit. And before, nobody ever thought that we would find these types of materials. And what it means is that this Indian civilization in many ways reached into Central Asia. And this got people very excited.
Yeah.
Because number one, because these materials don't exist in India for the most part, because the climate's much too moist.
Okay.
But so what happens is, after the discovery of that manuscript, you began to have so-called scholar explorers come in. And archaeologists, R.L. Stein is a perfect example of this, of that combination, come in and begin to do surveys and archaeological surveys of Central Asia. And so it was during this period that they began to get word of this great Buddhist site, and also a site with lots of manuscripts,
right,
and that
right.
got them very, very excited.
Based on the fact that the tours with Westerners in Dunhuang make it a point to recount this history of the Western explorers and the purchasing of many of the manuscripts, is China making any efforts to get these manuscripts back? I mean, especially like the Diamond Sutra?
Not on a large basis. I mean, so what we have is we have a lot of scholars working together, Chinese scholars with, say, British scholars or French scholars, on an increasingly large basis. And also museums and institutions working together. And so what we find now is that on the scholarly end of things, a lot of these materials have been digitized by the International Dunhuang Project. And this it's a remarkable project for the amount of material, and it's based out of the British Library. And they've, in the process over the years, gotten a number of other institutions on board, and the Chinese, also the French, the Russians, the Germans, to begin to digitize their materials, manuscripts and paintings. So this is one thing that has sort of lessened the desperation for return finds, because scholars have access to the materials worldwide now. Regarding so-called plunderers, R.L. Stein is often labeled that, but as you mentioned, he actually purchased the manuscripts. Of course, that's controversial, but also there was Langdon Warner, who was is from your alma mater, and he's notorious for having used a technique which he thought was innovative to basically use tape, simplifying it, to put on the murals and rip them off.
Okay.
And in the process, some were damaged, but he actually has a receipt.
Okay.
For these. So Harvard's response will be, for example, we have a receipt. They were paid for. We bought them in good order.
It's all very legal.
It's all very legal, exactly. You know, people might disagree with the methods and the authorities he spoke to actually purchase the material. So, of course, there's a lot of room for debate on this issue.
And I think, like, in a talk you gave previously, you had mentioned that the abbot had tried to get the Qing dynasty and the emperor interested in it. Could you just talk a little bit more about that?
Yeah, Wang Yuanlu is the person renovating the cave site around the year 1900 when he discovered the cache of manuscripts. And it's a fantastic cache of manuscripts. He recognized that, you know, they were important, but it wasn't. He wanted to get in touch with the authorities in order to know what to do with these manuscripts. And in fact, the Qing Dynasty authorities weren't that interested. And part of the slow response of the Chinese government at the time was that it was dominated by Confucian elites, and they saw Buddhist materials as simply not that interesting. Right, so this is one reason I believe that the process was slowed down for the Chinese government to recognize the value of these this incredible find.
And just to like fast forward a bit in time, there like when you go to the Mogao Caves, you still see a tremendous amount of art on the walls. You see a tremendous amount of the carvings. How are these cave arts able to survive the Cultural Revolution as well as the campaign against the Four Olds that sought to destroy a lot of Buddhist art?
Well, Mogao and Dunhuang was fortunate because they had a powerful patron, if you will, Zhou Enlai, Premier Zhou Enlai. And he was hugely supportive of the renovation project, the project to stabilize the cliff face, to begin a catalog process, and also research in general. And so he specifically said that Mogao caves were not to be damaged. And I have to put in a plug here also for the Dunhuang Research Academy and the people there who'd been scholars there who'd been working on the materials for literally dozens of years at that point, that they made a serious effort to talk to Red Guards to discuss the value of the materials there. So.
And what about today? What's being done to preserve the caves, and will preservation be successful, especially as more tourists come to Dunhuang?
Right. So part of the problem with the caves today is that moisture and also carbon dioxide is beginning to deteriorate the caves. There's also groundwater coming up because there's a lot of irrigation to make pretty gardens, if you will, in front of the attraction, and so that water is seeping up into the caves. So the lower levels of caves, you can, at the bottom of the murals, they're beginning to completely deteriorate. So what's been done over the last three decades is that the Getty Conservation Institute has gotten involved, the Getty Museum in LA. And that's since 1985. So it's been their longest-running project of conservation, heritage conservation. And so they've been instrumental at working with the Dunhuang Research Academy and also the Chinese government in creating, number one, an analysis, a very detailed analysis of the materials involved in the construction of the caves, how they deteriorate, why they deteriorate, and ways to prevent it. On top of that, there's also a digitization project going on. And part of that is to, along with the visitor center that recently opened, is to have to provide tourists with an alternative experience,
right?
So through the visualization or the immersive visualization and of the caves themselves at the visitor center, and then to decrease the number of visitors actually going in the caves.
No, the visitor center is very, very impressive and a lot of fun, and which leads me to think that they're hoping that a lot more people come to visit it. For people who aren't China people, China scholars, what do you think is the significant? What's the significance of these caves? Like, why should just regular Americans, when they take a trip to China, why should they go out to Dunhuang?
Well, so the caves, which span in their creation 1,000 years, are the largest repository of Chinese art. And maintain and contain items in designs and styles, aesthetics, and also the very space itself that doesn't exist anywhere else in China. So in terms of this kind of immersive experience, you can't get better than Dunhuang to see how people experienced Buddhism in the Tang, for example, period. So that's a major reason. And, you know, Dunhuang itself and the Mogao Caves, the site is stunning. And it gives you a sense of what the power of trade that unfolded over 1,000 years on the Silk Roads, or Silk Route, if you will. And this was... this was the caves themselves have a cosmopolitanism. Dun Huang at that time, we know from manuscripts, was incredibly mixed and well integrated, and so there's a fascination with that as well.
Finally, can you describe your favorite cave and why it's your favorite cave? You have to have a favorite.
Okay.
You can't love them all.
Well, so in spite of its formulaic nature, there's a cave, Cave 98, which is remarkable. It's quite large. It's a large family cave. It's an elite cave. But it also, what's fascinating for me, is it's well preserved, but it also lays out the political nature of the caves, the political nature of Buddhism also. And so you have large donor portraits of the king of Khotan and his relations to the Dun Huang elite. And it's remarkable for that reason that, you know, here we have a sort of detailed outline of the of political alliances that were being constructed and set in a ritual space, which is a cave, in this sort of liturgical moment. Again, that's in some ways frozen in time. And that's what these caves do, right? So they maintain relationships both among people and also with the Buddha forever and ever. And I find that fascinating. And Cave 98 is particularly rich in the historical political elements.
Okay, well, thank you again, Dr. Schmid, for your enlightening explanation of the Morgao Caves. And hopefully more people will go there but not breathe on the caves. So thank you.
Thank you very much.